The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
Okay, let's look at some of the stories that have been making the news this week that we haven't had a chance to discuss. And let's start with yesterday's parade in Washington. Donald Trump apparently was very taken by the military display he saw in Paris a couple of years ago, the Bastille Day celebrations, and said, "I want that for the United States of America." Now, his critics were saying, you don't bring tanks into Washington and you don't bring fighter jets in the way that was done yesterday, because you start looking like you're one of these Eastern European dictatorships, even if the French do it themselves as well. But it was all to commemorate, of course, Independence Day yesterday, harking back to the late 1770s. And that's relevant. If you hear this little clip for the speech, what jumps out as you as sounding particularly odd?
"The Continental Army suffered a bitter winter of Valley Forge, found glory across the waters of the Delaware, and seized victory from Cornwallis of Yorktown. Our army manned the airport. It ran the ramparts. It took over the airports. It did everything it had to do. And at Fort McHenry, under the rocket's red glare, it had nothing but victory. And when dawn came, their star-spangled banner waved defiant."
An emotional Donald Trump there. Claire Grady is journalist and Niall Shanahan, communications director of Force, are with us. Very emotional sounding Donald Trump there, particularly about the way that they controlled the airports.
I know, which was obviously some massive accomplishment, you know, 100 and something years before anybody actually flew. I mean, if we'd known they had airports back in that day. I mean, it sounded like something from Saturday Night Live. I mean, it absolutely sounded like it was scripted by, you know, Saturday Night Live, and that it was just this top of the head, emotional sort of stream of consciousness for a man who was not thinking about what he was saying.
Hang on, he clearly was reading it from the autocue. There's no doubt he was reading
this. It's not one mention of airports. It's two mentions of airports. How did that get on? Who wrote the script? Did somebody interfere with the script? Did somebody interfere with the autocue? Or was he just not able to read?
It also would suggest, now, wouldn't it, that he actually hadn't read the script in advance. I mean, most people, if they're delivering a major speech, particularly something like that, will at least have read it once, and probably read it more than once and practiced reading it. He read it like it was maybe the first time, because if it wasn't his first time seeing it, how the hell would he have left that error slip through?
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of that scene in the Ron Burgundy film where Ron will read anything that's on the autocue, and, you know, his colleagues get him into, or his, I think one of his rivals gets him into trouble by putting inappropriate stuff up in the autocue. But not for the first time. This highlights the fact that Donald Trump is probably somebody who struggles to read. Because he, like what struck, what in that clip that we heard, the bit that jumped out at me is where he says, "Our army manned the amparts. It ran the ramparts." It was like he couldn't understand the words in front of him. Now, I've seen American...
But maybe he just doesn't understand military terms, because remember this guy now who was glorifying the army yesterday had managed on five times to dodge the Vietnam draft.
Because of his bone spurs,
yeah.
Which I think is rich man's language for not doing what working class people are required to do when they're drafting people into a war. But I mean, the sad and annoying part about this is that the Trump supporters in the Republican Party don't care. I mean, we hear time and time again, like Trump's gaffes have been, you know, world news now for 3 years since the election was running. And it doesn't dim or diminish at all the level of support he receives from both the Republican Party and his own supporters. I don't see this stuff getting in the way of him being re-elected
next year.
Because
it's condescending, educated people who want to point out this thing about airports, isn't it?
I know, yeah. I mean, exactly. It might be a bit nitpicky, but the point that Niall's making about his ability to read, it isn't the first time this has come up.
Yeah,
and it could well have been
that
the word fort was up there, and in the context of military achievements, he read it wrong as airports. I mean, it's hard to understand how that can happen, but this isn't a man who suffers from stage fright or anything like that. You can understand if it's somebody early public speaking, you could make mistakes like that. But this is a man who kind of revels in sort of going off on one and just kind of talking away, top of the head, stream of consciousness. He clearly was trying to read from the autocue and just, I think, misread words. Misspoke.
Yeah, but I mean,
and I suppose when he was doing The Apprentice, he would get a second take.
And probably a third and a fourth take. Yeah. I mean, that programme, all reality television is very heavily edited and shot from multiple angles with multiple takes. But it's this lionisation of leaders like Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un and wanting to emulate that those kind of vanity parades, that's the bit that's really sickly about all of this. But I don't see it, you know, preventing him marching on for a second term.
I'm laughing, your listener giving out to me. There's a few Trump fans out there who listen and once a slip of the tongue like getting Nicki Minaj's name wrong, which is a go at me. But there is a difference, isn't there, that you're reading an autocue on a major state event. And when you actually say something as stupid that you actually either haven't read it before or you read something and should realise, hold on a second, I can't say that. We never had airports back in the 18th century. And yet people are supposed to excuse him for that.
Yeah, well, think of the trouble he'll be in if Jeremy Hunt becomes the next Prime Minister, speaking of verbal gaffes. Jeremy, there's one about Jeremy Hunt that kind of follows him around, and there's a great supercut on YouTube of people getting his name wrong.
Oh. I'm just told there's an excuse come out that they've thought up an excuse in the White House that apparently there was a problem with the teleprompter. It was hard to read in the rain, so he misread it in the rain.
Twice he misread
it. And why would he have thought of airport? If he could find it hard to read it, why would he start talking about airports? Excuse him?
You can get a thing about anning the am parts. You know what I mean? Missing letters like that, but reading an airport way over.
We can look forward to next year's parade when he'll announce that man landed on the moon in 1869 rather than 1969.
Well, listener says, have you ever thought that he may need glasses, but he may see wearing glasses as a form of weakness?
That's a good point, yeah. For somebody as narcissistic as him, that would be a stretch.
Okay, let's move on from that. The other was a story that I thought was horrific during the week to hear about. And then the way it was covered in the English newspapers. This is about the story, Claire, of a man who fell to his death from a plane, a flight from Nairobi to London.
Absolutely tragic. People may have read about it. A body literally dropped from the sky into a garden, you know, near Heathrow Airport.
And we'll get to that bit in a moment.
Yeah. But OK, what's emerged? Obviously, it was a stowaway. The flight was from Nairobi. There was later found to be in the wheel area of the plane.
And this is what happens is that sometimes people get on board. The stowaways, they go in. But what happens is, and this is a terrible thing, they get into the aircraft, but they freeze to death in the part of the aircraft that they go into.
They freeze to death or they get burnt by the wheels when the wheels come up. Because, I mean, obviously they're at a very high temperature and they don't survive. It goes into, I don't know how many minus degrees the plane goes in or the atmosphere goes into. It's a non-pressurised zone of the airport, obviously, of the airplane. And this poor person got on, presumably in Nairobi. There was a bag, there was food in, stowed away as well, and fell out over London. And it was, all the trappings and everything were just, all the stuff he had stowed away were discovered after the plane landed. And it looks like he may have been an airport employee, because otherwise they find it difficult to understand how he would have got airside, how he would have got through security to be able to get to that part of the plane. That's what they're saying anyhow.
And then, Niall, the Times newspaper ran the most extraordinary headline the day afterwards saying, sunbather nearly hit by falling body is Oxford graduate.
Yeah, I mean, this is just tone-deaf reporting of the highest order. I did notice when I was watching the television coverage during the week that the unfortunate man had fallen in a very affluent part of Clapham in South London. The houses on the street and the cars parked outside gave an indication of considerable wealth,
wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that. I'm merely setting the scene. But for the Times then to report that the man sunbathing in his back garden was an Oxford graduate kind of misses the point.
It's like Boris Johnson. It could have been Boris.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't tempt me.
It's almost like the real tragedy here is that it could have, I mean, this man's fall from the sky could have taken out an Oxford graduate. That seems to be what the subtext is here.
Yeah, I mean,
here.
The same man's children apparently were playing in the garden a little while before it happened. And, you know, I mean, we all play the what ifs when things like that happen. And I'm sure for the family involved, deeply traumatising and very upsetting. But that's just bad reporting, bad
journalism.
There
was another story earlier this year. I don't think, Claire, you might have been here the day we covered it.
We were.
In relation to a story about an Irish human rights lawyer, a woman from Belfast, who had been jailed after shouting racist abuse at Air India staff on a flight. And it's been a very, very sad outcome to this story.
Very sad. I was actually discussing it on a Friday here, Matt, when she had just been arrested. The video had just gone viral, as they say. This woman, Simone Burns, was born in Belfast. She was a human rights lawyer and on a flight from India, and she was videoed you know, being abusive to staff. I mean, incredibly abusive, and you know, I mean, being racist towards them. And but she was charged. She was arrested. She was charged. And I remember at the time discussing kind of, oh, it'd be interesting to see how that sort of behaviour is treated, because she's a lawyer, a very middle class person, and we were speculating, you know, would the court go as heavy on her as they would with, you know, some drunken people in a tracksuit? They did go heavy on her. They sentenced her to 6 months in jail. That was in April. She was released from prison 6 weeks or 8 weeks into the sentence. And it has just emerged in the last couple of days that she was found dead at Beachy Head, a well-known spot in England where people kill themselves. So she was found dead a few days, I think 2 weeks after she got out of jail. And it's now emerged that, I mean, her life, she felt her life was destroyed.
She had received death threats online as well.
It had been, I mean, there had been huge comment on it at the time. And of course, the other thing that emerges now, there are now people talking about that she was a very selfless woman, a very warm woman, did a huge amount of work, was, as I say, a human rights lawyer, worked on behalf of refugees. And it's almost as if this particular incident that happened, and that happened to be filmed, and that happened to go up on YouTube and Twitter and all of the rest of it, it's almost like it wiped every other good thing she had ever done, you know, out of people's minds, and people who didn't know her. And I mean, I have to admit, we had a discussion, a hot and heavy discussion about it here on this show. But she, you know, I mean, like the whole humiliation of having to go to court, having to pay a high price, as in terms of being jailed. But it appears that she couldn't take that.
Niall Shanahan, what do you make of this?
It's a deeply, deeply tragic story. Myself and Claire were talking before we came on the air, and Claire was making that point about how, you know, a lifetime of good work would appear to have been completely overshadowed by this incident. And I would question, there was probably a degree of aftercare that was absolutely required when she was released from prison. I just wonder in what way was her situation or her individual case handled. The journalist and author John Ronson has written about this.
We've discussed it with him on this programme.
So he's been publicly shamed, and he's detailing a number of cases where people have been shamed online, and the extraordinary lengths they have to go to try and overcome that experience. I mean, we all do things at some point in our lives that embarrass us.
But some people handle them in different ways. I mean, somebody like a Donald Trump, who we started the programme with, has absolutely no shame about anything that they would do. And then other people are deeply ashamed by a mistake they may have made, something they've done under the influence of alcohol, perhaps.
And if that happens very publicly and it's videoed and widely posted, and then you can't hide away from that degree of public opprobrium, I can only imagine that the pressure on an individual's mental health is immense. And I mean, the outcome it's deeply sad.
Have you ever looked at that app on your phone which allows you to calculate how much time you spent looking at your phone in that particular week, and been absolutely shocked to see just how much time you spend looking at it? Well, what about the employers who are worried about the productivity of their employees and who believe that as a result, they should be able to confiscate their smartphones when they arrive at work and give them back on their way out? Claire Grady, what do you make of the idea?
It's an extraordinary story that's emerged this week. He sounds like an Irish man. He was a marketing company in Yorkshire, and he's advertising for workers and laying it on the line here that he doesn't want workers who spend their days on their smartphones. And he's introduced a policy that he will be confiscating workers' phones. Now, it's slightly ironic that it's a marketing company, so presumably a lot of his business is done by people on phones. But anyhow, he's making the point, and a lot of people have kind of sort of agreed to him. Yeah, it is very distracting at work for people to be on their phones when that isn't their job. But I think most people draw the line at actually having to hand in their phone to their bosses, you know what I mean, to be treated in such a childlike way. But it may come.
What do you think, Niall? Well, Niall Shanahan, now, given that you're a union representative, how do you think the workers would react in any business that has been done?
Well, I was thinking about this, and I mean, really, it depends on the job that people are doing and the degree to which they need to be present and paying attention. Like, we represent, you know, workers in health and aviation who, I'm sure, would have no business taking out their smartphone in the course of their working day, because the level of concentration required for what they do would mean that, you know, distractions like that just couldn't be entertained. And then there are other, I suppose, working environments where maybe there's downtime. I know of a young man working in a restaurant in town at the moment, and when the restaurant isn't busy, the waiting staff tend to take out their phones and take a little look at what's happening on their Instagram or whatever. And this is an agitation to the management.
Yeah, because you're there in your seat and you're trying to get the attention of a waiter or waitress or whatever, and you can see them up at the counter just scrolling through their Instagram feed.
If you saw that, it's not a good look for any place. You know, I mean, a member of the public who's a customer in a restaurant wants to feel that, you know, attention has been placed upon them and their needs looked after. But I mean, it hasn't surfaced as an issue, as far as I'm aware, in industrial relations practice. Maybe it's only a matter of time before they do. But actually, it's more about the right to switch off. I think that's going to emerge an employer worker issue before this ever becomes a big issue, where the employer can reach you after hours, be it through email or text message or WhatsApping. I've heard of stories recently of employers adding employees to WhatsApp groups without their consent and then getting a message at 11 o'clock at night for something they need them to do for the next day.
I hadn't heard of that, but I hope nobody I know gets the idea of adding me in for a group like that.
Well, it's outlawed in France. Your employer can't contact you after office hours. They can only instruct and delegate work to you within office hours. And that law was introduced in direct response to that need to be able to switch off from work. But actually, this article is funny because it talks about a separation anxiety, a phenomenon called nomophobia. A 2010 study coined the term, and about half the population in the UK suffering from it. And this is anxiety felt when cut off from one's mobile device. But the source of anxiety is not so much that they can't access their social media. It's got more to do with not being able to stay in contact with their loved ones. So
FOMO, isn't it?
Fear of missing out, yeah. Somebody explained that to me very recently, what that meant.
Okay, moving on. Of course, in Britain, they're still at school, I think. They have a much shorter
school
holiday.
Up, yeah.
So maybe just break it, because the next story is one that probably is a bit out of date for Irish schools, which primary schools ended last week. Secondary schools have been closed for a while now. But they're having problems at school sports days, where they're having to ban parents for abusive and intimidating language.
This is a great
story.
This is
a bit like silent sideline now, and fairness is required on the sports pitches around
Absolutely.
The country here.
Yeah.
A school principal in Wales has written to parents after their most recent sports day, which was in the last week or two, saying that henceforth parents would be banned from attending sports days. And it's a real tradition over the last couple of decades, I guess, for parents. It's the one day, one of the few days of the year where they get to go along, you know, meet other parents, you know, have a kind of a nice sort of sports day, social day with their kids. And principal has banned it now because of the abuse that the teachers were getting, the bad language that was coming from the parents, and the general sort of carry on from the sidelines of parents. But now, some of the parents have spoken to the BBC and have said that, well, they didn't witness anything themselves, but they have high regard for this principal. So they're not saying, she's not trying to pull a fast one or looking for publicity or anything. It's obviously something has happened. And she said it's not the first time it's happened. It's happened a couple of times before. And from here on in, she just wants the kids left alone and not to be exposed to that.
The curse of pushy parents. I mean, we've gone, you know, there's all sorts of extremes. You also get these sports days where everybody has to be a winner rather than actually rewarding those.
Let's celebrate mediocrity by giving everybody a medal,
yeah,
no matter where they finish in the
Do
race.
Do you like that idea?
I mean, I say that with my tongue in my cheek, Matt, to be fair. Because I think, you know, the thing is, I think if you had a sports day and there were no medals handed out to any of the kids, that they were just given, you know, prizes in the form of sweets or lollipops or ice creams and just told
Hang
to
on,
enjoy themselves.
Hang on, you were trying to deal with the obesity crisis and you're telling them out.
They're burning it off in the potato sack race, Matt. You know, it's all about the cardiovascular. They've got to replace those calories, you know.
There's a mix. Sometimes the kids get put in teams. So even the weak kids, perhaps the weaker athletic kids, get a chance and they
Surely
win something
the
as
origin
part
of the
team.
The three-legged race, you know, is where you pair weak with strong, and it's about
teamwork. Yeah, okay, but what does it say about the parents that they actually are so loutish, or they have living out their own athletic past or athletic failures through the lives of their children and then end up roaring and screaming abuse at teachers because their little kid isn't perhaps doing as well as they'd hoped?
No, I mean, it doesn't bring out the best in people, but you know, status anxiety in the outside the school gates is, I think it's a more widespread phenomenon than we give it credit for. You know, people trading stories about where they're going to go on holidays on the last day of term. That's always one to generate a little status anxiety. You know, the families who do go on skiing holidays meeting the families who don't go on skiing holidays. and the families who've just bought a new car and the families who are still driving the Jammer, you know, for 10 years. And there's all of that certain amount of, shall we say, showing off that can go on at the school gates as well. And I think this phenomenon at the school sports day is an extension of the same thing.
OK, and finally, one thing I think we mentioned it the other night on television, but I don't think we got into it in detail. Netflix pledging to cut back on smoking on screen with its own programmes. Because apparently its own season 3 of Stranger Things hasn't done that. But I suppose it's reflecting the reality of the 1980s, where many more people smoked than they do now. But should that be airbrushed out, so to speak?
Well, I think what the concern is here is that programmes that are particularly watched and very popular among young people, and there were studies done of the programmes that are very popular among young people and the incidence of smoking, and it's to do with the normalising. And the Stranger Things, which is one of the few programmes here that I have watched, and it is representing like the 1970s into the 1980s when smoking was really, really prevalent. But I'm guessing it's the same reason that they don't feature smoking in, you know, modern programmes as much, is because it normalises it, makes it attractive, the cool people smoke. I mean, nowadays, if you see smoking in a film, it's the baddie, it's the kind of somebody with a problem. I mean, I think in some of the, you know, more recent detective and crime series, somebody who was caught somebody who was smoking, like they had inner issues and stuff like that. So it's a kind of, it's now become a shorthand for somebody who's troubled. Whereas in previous programmes, nice people, good people, the heroes all smoked. So I'm guessing, I mean, it would be dreadful to think of, you know, Humphrey Bogart or any of those, if they ever got to the stage of rinsing those or not showing those movies because the hero smoked. That would be terrible. But I kind of get it now on the more contemporary films.
Okay, some of your comments just to finish. Your last word, 0874 100 102. I have a childminder who's progressively gotten more and more addicted to her mobile phone. She actually can't hold a conversation with me without checking her phone. And I'm leaving my four kids in her care. I'm paying a high fee for it. It's a real bone of contention. We're parting company shortly, and a stipulation of the new contract of employment with my new childminder will be no phone use while minding my kids. But how will you be able to check on that when you've left the kids with her? And here's another one. This is a really good one from Ruth in Limerick. Pedantic, I know, but manned flight began in the 1700s with the Montgolier brothers in a balloon. No airports, but there was manned flight. And indeed, it has been suggested during the War of Independence that balloons were used in limited ways at the time. But as Ruth says, there may have been balloons, but there sure as hell weren't any airports. Thank you very much, Niall Shanahan and Claire Grady, for being with us.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.